Welcome to Double X Science. It's in your genes. Today is Friday, August 9th, 2013. I am Adrienne Rorick, chemistry editor, and with me today is Chris Gunter, science ed editor at Double X Science.
Hey, everyone.
So, Chris, you and I both have kids, and they're heading back to school. What are some of the back-to-school preparations you're doing?
I have to say, I am so excited, and my son is so not excited. It's cool. Yeah, we got all our school supplies and signed him up for clubs. He's going to start taking chess this year, so that'll be interesting. How about you guys?
Well, just on a side note before I say that, my son took chess, like, when he was little. We had him signed up for chess classes. He loved them, and then when we moved to Seattle, his school offered a chess club, and he did that for 1 or 2 years.
And cool.
Really, yeah, 2 years. And he really enjoyed it. He's not competitive, so he wouldn't do any of the competitive stuff, but he really liked that. So I hope your son really likes it too.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so my kids don't start till the day after Labor Day, which is like the latest my kids have ever started school.
Wow, mine is Monday. I can't even imagine.
Wow, please. Monday already.
Yeah, jeez. Yeah.
So like when this posts,
exactly.
Your son's going to be in school.
Yay! Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, so my husband works from home, so he's been home with the kids, and he's like, I'm ready for them to go back.
Exactly.
But I think, like, we still need to buy school supplies, we still need to go get school clothes, we need to start getting them up earlier than 10 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the whole thing.
Yeah, so we're not prepared at all.
Yeah, well, you got time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moving into more science, let's talk about what's been on Double X Science blog since our last podcast on July 19th. The first post we had after our last podcast was called The Gummy Deficiency.
I found this one interesting because, as we just talked about, both of us have had kids and so had to take prenatal vitamins. And I didn't realize until this nice article by Joss Fung that a lot of the most common prenatal gummy vitamin out there, as opposed to pill form, doesn't have thiamine, riboflavin, or iron in it, which is bad because when you're pregnant, of course, you're making blood for you and for the baby, and you need to store up blood because you're going to give birth, which often involves a lot of blood. And to take a prenatal vitamin without iron is just not a good idea at all.
Yeah. I didn't personally take gummy vitamins because I don't like gummy things.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't either. I took the pills, but yeah. This is shocking.
It is. It's a good reason to always sort of read your labels on any sort of supplement that you're taking and verify that it is an appropriate supplement. It has the appropriate amounts because some of these supplements give you way too much for what your daily allowance should be. And some things that's totally not important, your body will just excrete the excess, but some things can actually cause issues. So it's always good to take a look at your vitamins. Oh, I see. So these supplements were not approved by the US FDA. So that's another thing to always check with because supplements.
Vitamins don't have to. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so, right, exactly. That's a great point. Ladies, check if you're in that state, please check your labels because these VitaFusion is the one that Joss looked at. Prenatal gummies don't have any iron at all, which is just really not a good idea. Yeah. So.
And really any supplements that you take for any reason.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. We also had a wonderful, as always, book review from our physics editor, Matthew Francis, called Scientific Realities Trump Paleo Fantasy. This book is Paleo Fantasy by Marlene Zook, and it's actually aimed at like the paleo diet and when people go ahead and go into a kind of a nostalgia for how we evolved and what's the best way to, you know, eat or basically take on a lifestyle based on supposedly how we evolved and supposedly how we were during a particular period of time.
And what our ancestors did. I had no idea until reading this book review that there were paleo exercises too. I'd heard of paleo diets, right? But there, this made me Google, there are actually paleo exercises, which are actually not that far off from that New York Times article, which went viral a little while ago, the 7 exercises you need for a healthy life. But these are, in a way, like that squatting, bending, running, that kind of thing. But, you know, all the stuff say we don't need posh gyms or whatever. and we could just do these exercises wherever. It's interesting. This book seems to focus a lot on the paleo diet, and Matthew and the author make a good point that just because our ancestors gave up drinking milk at some point or evolved in different ways, that doesn't mean that we should do the same thing now, because things have progressed quite a bit since the Paleolithic era.
Just a little.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, for example, they didn't have bread, and that doesn't mean that we should not have bread now, because it's been quite some time. So it's just really interesting. If you have any friends that are doing the paleo diet or that kind of lifestyle, this is something they should definitely check out.
Yeah. Then we had The Gift of Depression and Mood Disorder, and this particular article appeared as one in our series of our I Am Mental Illness. And that series is, we still are accepting submissions for that, and they post every so often. And I think this was a very enlightening post, because the crux of it was that Sarah Boone, who wrote this post, suffers from major depression with a side of, anxiety with a side of mood disorder. And so, she talks about how when she saw a psychiatrist, how he tried to specifically diagnose what kind of mood disorder, whether it was cyclothymia or the bipolar 2. And it's because of how successful she'd been throughout her life. And the crux of the issue is, yeah, her life was super successful, and that's because when you have those ups, you can sometimes be super productive, and it can cloud the lows. And so when you have these checklists of things to say, oh, it's this, it's that, it's this, it's that, and you have this, you have to have had this time frame of being down and that time frame of being up, and how far down did you go and how far up did you go and which direction you went, that sometimes the way some people deal with this is that their ups completely sort of cloud their lows, and they're very able to hide their lows, and that they're very successful because of the way their ups are. You know, maybe they're very engaging, and so mm-hmm. their spouse is willing to overlook when they go down, because when they're up, they are really wonderful people. And the thing is when you're down, then what you say is, I have to get out of bed because I have to get to this meeting because I have to keep up appearances. And
right.
at a certain point, you go so far down, you can't do that,
right.
but...
And that's when you get diagnosed, right? Yeah.
But, you know, up until then, it works. And so I think that's interesting, because in some ways, you know, the mood disorder had been very rewarding for her.
As a professor, right? She was still able to become...
Exactly.
To be productive as a professor, yeah.
Exactly. Right. When the depression it actually allowed her to take the rest and the break that she needed in some ways. So while depression is very serious and scary, and it certainly, as she says, almost killed her, it helped her take the time and step back and learn how to appreciate life. So I really enjoyed this post, and not in a schadenfreude way. I thought this was immensely enlightening, and I hope that it helps a lot of people who are either in the same place or need to see.
Know people that are.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and like you said, that's the whole gift of our I Am Mental Illness series as well, is that we've been able to relate to people who are going through this stuff and realize that they're us, mm-hmm. right? They're all around. So that's really important. Yeah.
All right. And Matthew Shipman wrote a post that, I don't know if I can bring myself to read it. It's called Back to School Fact Checked, very similar to the back to school stuff that Chris and I are doing with our kids. And it's all about head lice.
Head lice, yay. I don't know if anybody else has a parent that emails them or sends them newspaper clippings like mine does. My mom has sent me clippings about how to deal with lice for like 3 years now. My son has never had lice. We've never been around them, and yet I have all this stuff from out. So, anyways, I had to forward this back to her and tell her that our friend Matthew Shipman dealt with a lot of the myths about lysine. It was really interesting. So I've heard a number of these, particularly the myth that you should put mayonnaise or petroleum jelly or olive oil or tea tree oil in your child's hair to get rid of the lice, to suffocate them. And I've heard that from a lot of people as fact, as truth. And he says in here, no, that doesn't help. That may suffocate the adult lice, but then they won't kill the eggs, so that's not a good way to treat the infestation.
Yeah. That I've heard about that for like ticks. I actually hadn't heard about that for lice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe it's because I'm in the South. People use mayonnaise.
Whatever they can use mayonnaise for, huh?
That's exactly right. I hate mayonnaise. So, and he deals with myths. So it's not true that if you have curly hair or dirty hair or long hair, you're more likely to get head lice. All of those are actually false. And he also points out that, there are a number of different treatments, that you should use. The best ones being permethrin and pyrethroids, which are available over the counter, like Nix and Rid. And goes through a number of the treatments there. So, you know, if your kids are going back to school and you don't have a mom like mine who sends you all that stuff, here it is, all in one place for
That's
you.
Nice.
So check it out.
Well, I like that he points out specifically the dirty, curly, long hair issue because that will, you know, hopefully help avoid some stigma with head lice and those poor kids who get head lice and they'll be like, oh, it's because you're dirty, and it's not.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's, you speaking of school supplies, that's something that we had to buy this year is every kid has to bring in their own headphones because they were using headphones that had an over-the-head component and they were sharing lice that way in lots of schools. So lots of schools are going to making kids bring in their own headphones.
Oh, that's good. My kids have had lice, and the way they've always gotten them was through Little League, where they share the Little League helmet.
Right. Yes, exactly.
And yeah, but see, we've always used like the Nix or Rid and then a really, really fine tooth comb to comb it out.
Yeah, and that's basically what he says here. So see, you did well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. Some of these I had never heard of. That's funny. That's good too that he talks about that head lice are not a disease vector. So.
Right. Exactly.
Maybe, maybe some people confuse ticks and head lice.
Right. Well, they're both yucky.
Our most recent post is called Smoke Signals, Cancers, Edges, and Surgery by our own tech editor, Jeffrey Perkel.
Yay, Jeff. I like this one because it was really interesting. So it talked about something called the eye knife, intelligent knife or eye knife, because everything's eye now, right? And this is a surgical tool that is coupled to a mass spectrometer. And then what it does is as it is cutting, using an electric current, so basically burning the tissue, it's vaporizing chemicals. And so by coupling it to a mass spec, they were able to analyze the lipids that are coming off. And over time, they could teach the machine, basically, by looking at healthy and cancerous and diseased tissues, what is a profile of lipids for cancer and what is a profile for not cancer, and then let the knife do a lot of the surgery and tell them when it had reached the edges of the tumor and when it was in normal tissue based on the lipid profile around it. So this is an article that appeared in the journal Science Translational Medicine, but it's really interesting. That will be interesting if that becomes more widespread.
Well, it sounds like it could very easily help with loss of removal of, excess matter that you don't want to remove, especially in, say, brain surgery. Or leaving behind cancer tissue, because I think that also is a concern when you do a cancer surgery and treatment. And that's one reason you do, I believe, all the chemotherapy is just to make sure all the cancer cells are killed and removed. But that would really help because then it would say, okay, I've definitely gotten to the boundary here. And I found it interesting that it flagged some cells that it wasn't sure. It said, well, they're not normal. I don't think these are cancer and end up being like Crohn's disease.
Yes, because they have inflammation similarly and that kind of thing. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. But that's good. It's learning, right? And we're learning, right? So.
Yeah, this sounds very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can find all those posts at our website, doublelicksigns.org, by clicking on the links to the post titles on the main page. In addition to our Double X Science site postings, our sister site, Double X Science Junior, had a few posts since our last podcast. We had one on Professor Elizabeth H. Blackburn as a part of the scientist series that the Double X Science Junior contributors were doing, as a part of their Future Science Leaders projects. And I believe that's the last one for those, and actually you can look forward to a Notable Women in Science that kind of summarizes these two on the main Double X Science website. We also had a post on laser light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, and another call on the use of cesium for wildlife tracking.
I like that one. I thought that was really a nice post. It looks like by Valzabi there, which talked about how they turned the Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster into something scientific, which was that explosion released cesium of a certain isotope into the water, and tuna, which were around, ate that. And so colleagues at people at Stanford University did a study tracing the tuna and other fish which had taken those up, and they were able to use that as a way to track the migrations of tuna.
Oh, that is really cool that they were able to make this into something that they needed to know.
Exactly, yeah. And they said they want to use it for other things like whales and turtles and sharks as well. Tying us into Shark Week, which, as we know, is going on this week. So, well done, Double X Science Junior.
Exactly. My question is, when they track them, though, then they have to catch these and also then extract, obviously, the tissue. So, do they just randomly pick what they're going to do, or like the fact that they're going to do tuna, or were they just specifically looking at tuna?
I think in this case, too, well, it says they knew they were looking specifically at tuna. That's probably just what this research group studied, because they knew that they spawned in Japanese waters and then moved from there.
Okay.
So they probably thought that was a good choice because since they know they spawn in Japan and will be taking up the isotope.
I see. All right.
That would be my guess.
Okay. Well,
so
always worth knowing. Well, maybe something to look into a little further on our own. That's always great when you read a science article and think, oh, I wonder this, and then you can go look and do some own science research
later
for yourself. Yeah.
Exactly.
So
I like it.
So you can find these posts at doublexsciencejunior.blogspot.com or by following the link from the doublexscience.org main page to doublexsciencejunior. Let's discuss some news. So, Chris, you told me all about the mapping of the genome of the HeLa cell line. Could you tell me more?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a big story that in my field in genetics, and really for anyone that has come out this week. So this has backstory, it has intrigue, it has all kind of stuff. There was a book which came out a few years ago now called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by science writer Rebecca Skloot, which was interesting because it was the backstory of one of the most famous cell lines that we use in biology labs all the time called HeLa cells. And those were a cervical cancer cell line. And they were one of the first ones that we could grow in a dish outside of a person. And we knew that was because they were cancerous, but we didn't know exactly why they had taken off, whereas other cancerous cell lines were not able to at that time be grown outside of people. But that enabled us to do lots of experiments in the lab. And if you look in our literature of biology, there are thousands and thousands of papers that have used HeLa cell lines. So it's enabled all kind of drug discovery and everything like that. And the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, set up this tension between there are pharmaceutical companies that have basically made money off these cells, and yet Henrietta Lacks herself and her family were never compensated for any of that. So then what happened more recently is last year, two different groups sequenced the genome of the HeLa cell line. And HeLa cells have so many different mutations that probably even the two isolates they have are different from each other. But because they're so old and it's been through so many passages and things happen in cancer cell lines. But a group in Germany sequenced their the HeLa cell line and just published their results and just put it out there. And the Lax family and other people around them were very upset by this because now her genomic information was all out there, and it could potentially reveal stuff about them that they might not want out there because this was their mother, for example. Yet, at the other hand, it's a real dilemma because most of the cell lines we have cannot be identified, but this one can be. And so the family was saying, well, you never should have put this out. And yet the researchers were saying, but that's what we do. We sequence cells all the time and we put the data out. In fact, we're under a compunction to make the data freely available. Right. That's what genomics is all about. So at the same time,
yes, but
that was
the one thing I would say in defense of like the Lax family is that when most of these, you know, scientific researchers, they don't have like a direct line back to a person that's been identified.
That's absolutely right. So that's what happened in the second case. In the U.S., there was a group, Jay Shinduri, at Seattle and colleagues sequenced also the HeLa cell line, and they did a lot more in-depth information on analysis of the actual chromosomes in that cell line. And since the NIH had some control over that because it was funded by the NIH, that paper, the Jay Shinduri paper, was submitted to Nature. It went through peer review. They were getting ready to publish it, and NIH stepped in and said, wait a minute, we don't want you to publish that. We've seen what's happened now with this German paper and how that's created such a fuss. So actually we'd like to go and talk to the Lax family and give them the option to determine publication or not. So this is unprecedented. So if you read the coverage in this week's issue of Nature, there's the paper about that. There are also two different news stories that talk about how this happened and how a deal was made, et cetera. And so Francis Collins, the director of NIH, himself got involved and went and visited with the Lax family. And Nature, in the meantime, agreed to hold publication of the paper all this time while this happened for months. Dr. Collins talked to the Lax family and gave them the option. They said, look, there's basically three different things that can happen here. You can just put the data out from the cell line and make it available to everyone, or we can put it into a database and people have to ask permission to use it, or we just won't put the data out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's unprecedented that he allowed them that option. And so they talked about it quite a bit and they went for the middle ground basically, which is these data are being released into a genomic database, but you have to apply for permission in order to be able to see them. And the Lax family and some researchers will judge who gets to see them and who doesn't.
Okay.
So it's interesting and it raises all kind of questions for our field because, for example, lots of people have done sequencing experiments on parts of HeLa. So they estimated, and they say this in this paper, that basically HeLa has been sequenced about 400 times over, and if you mine the databases, you could pull out about 400 times worth of data for that. So the data are kind of already out there, and yet they weren't out there in this complete a form.
Right.
So there you go.
Yeah, that's an interesting conundrum, you know, really. Yeah, it's a definite, it's an intersection of, you know, science and the way science is propagated and distributed and disseminated.
Yep.
And, you know, the rights of privacy for a group of people.
Exactly.
And, you know, it does link back to the fact that this woman, Henrietta Lax, was never asked for her cells, never, like, nobody ever signed a form that said, hey, I give you consent to use my cells the way you do now. You know, and then they've been used and, you know, they've done great things for the population, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, this is out there. So really, you know, like you said, it's got intrigue, it's got mystery, it's got all sorts of
and it's something that it ties into issues that we all need to think about. For example, you know, people put up the example of politicians. So if I wanted to find out dirt on President Obama, for example, or McCain or whoever, I could give them a cup and then take it after they've drunk out of it. And could I get enough saliva cells out of that to sequence their genome? And what could I release those information, right? And maybe it would say something about their DNA, et cetera. And this used to be kind of a far-fetched Manchurian candidate type scenario. It isn't anymore, right? I mean, that is something that could realistically happen. So that's something that we all need to think about in terms of being informed about our genomes and our privacy and what we're comfortable with, et cetera. So, really interesting read.
Well, and thinking about, I read the book Genome, and I think that's by Matt Ripley.
Matt Ridley.
Excuse me. And that's my, you know, sci-fi route showing.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Anyways, and I think he made clear in that book, now granted this was, what, late 90s, that, you know, we've potentially aligned all these genes with these diseases, but just because you have the genes doesn't mean you're going to get the disease, and, you know, it has to do with a lot more. But if people aren't clear on that, which I think a lot of people are not, you know, that you read all the time about how, you know, this gene is what causes asthma, and this gene causes, you know, red hair, and this gene causes, and it may or may not be what you're, you know, may or may not be true, right? It probably, yeah, you have a higher incidence rate with it, but then there's some other contributions. But if you just say, you know, have someone's genome, and you're like, oh, but they have the genome for Alzheimer's, and
they have mutations or variants for certain things. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's, I've been researching autism lately for work projects, and exactly, that's the case in autism. What we're going to find is not any one or two genes which, quote unquote, cause autism when they're mutated. We're going to find variants in hundreds or at least tens of genes, which all contribute to disturbing a network of gene products interacting together. And that leads to autistic behaviors or placement on the spectrum or something. So that's unsatisfying in a way for, as a parent, right, to not be able to say, oh, look, here's this one change in DNA which explains all this behavior. But on the other hand, it also makes it more difficult to treat, right? We can't just go in and fix one broken gene in the future, for example. It's going to be a combination of genes and some environmental factors all interacting with each other.
Right. I think, I tend to think of this in terms of like heart disease and the health industry. So like, you know, I think there have been genes that are linked to heart disease, but how you eat is also a very major player in that.
Paleo or not.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there's also some other environmental factors that aren't even diet or
stress.
Yeah. So, you know, so, but the thing is I can see, like, say for politicians to be like, oh, well, they have these heart disease genes, and so definitely we don't want them as our president because we don't want him to drop dead of a heart attack under the stress of the job, you know, never mind that they happen to eat exactly the way you're supposed to eat to avoid heart disease.
And they're fine, and they have no symptoms, right? I mean, yeah, exactly. It's that's why things like that are just not useful.
Then we walk into that line of, well, what about insurance? So can, you know, insurance say, well, you have this gene that says you are at higher risk for heart disease, so we're going to, you know, jack.
Yeah, you have a form of a gene. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's difficult. So that's why I think that Hila's story is really interesting. Read. It also sets up the, as we were touching on as well, it sets up interesting problems for researchers. So does this mean that for every cell line you're going to sequence the genome of now, you have to try to track down the individual who it was and get their okay on that, right? Yeah. I mean, that might impede research, for example. So that's a difficult line to walk. And an example of that is when I was at Nature, I handled the paper for Jim Watson's genome, and he said he wanted all of it deposited in public databases, except he didn't want the sequence of his ApoE gene locus, which has variants which are linked to an increased risk for Alzheimer's. He didn't want that gene locus out there. So we agreed that he could deposit everything. I was saying it had to be deposited into databases, but not this one part. But very quickly, because parts of the genome travel together, people could look at markers surrounding that place in the genome and figure out what sequence he must have at that locus. So it's kind of a, we didn't do this, but people figured it out anyway. So getting at the privacy issue, because that's something that he wanted not out there, and within, you know, a month or two, it was out there.
Right. Well, and this is also interesting because Rebecca Skloot did all this legwork on Henrietta Lacks, right? Nobody even cared or knew about her, really. I mean, I think all these researchers were like, hey, this is a great cell line, and they didn't necessarily stop to consider. I can't say that this is a very general, broad statement, and so I'm sure you had researchers who did say, you know, I wonder about the person who this came from, but it was this one person, so who did all the legwork. So you're right. You know, for every gene sequence that comes from who knows who, are the researchers now...
Should they have IRBs that actually require them to go out and meet people? I mean, a lot of these people we'd never be able to find. That was the point. It's supposed to be unidentified, right? Anonymous. So it's a very fine line that's
setting
up. Well,
and I think if you've stripped all the identity from it, that's one thing, right? But, for instance, HeLa cells were not stripped of their identity.
Those are her initials, right? Exactly. So it's easier to find her. And if people are interested in this more, they should also look at the website and blog post from a friend of ours, David Kroll, K-R-O-L-L, who does a lot of work at the North Carolina, in a North Carolina museum. And he was involved with the Lax family as well. So he's written a really nice post to look at as well.
Great. So I will definitely include the link to the news article Chris and I were discussing directly, and that also links off to several other places for you to take a look at more information. Also link to the David Kroll article.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that Nature one has a podcast as
well. Yeah, so if you like... if you like podcasts, which hopefully you do if you're listening to us.
Since you're listening to this one, exactly.
Okay. Let's see. So that about wraps up our week at Double X Science. Thank you, Chris, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking at our calendar here. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to have some really interesting things coming up. We have a post on malaria vaccines. We have a post about pink toys for girls, which should be very interesting. Another one called Not All Who Wander Are Lost. So I will be interested to see what that's about.
That sounds interesting. Some more intrigue.
That's exactly right.
All right, and thank you for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you are enjoying the podcast, please rate our podcast and leave a review at iTunes to help bring science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Our artwork is by Dallas Lopez. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at XXI. This has been Chemistry Editor Adrian Rurick and Science Ed Editor Chris Gunter. We are XXI Science, bringing science to the woman in you.